Today's Teisho will be on case 30 in the Book of Serenity. Case 30 is entitled Dasui's Aeonic Fire. Introduction: obliterating all oppositions, cutting off both sides, smashing the mass of doubt. How does that require a single phrase? The capital of the country is not an inch of a step away. The great mountain only weighs 3 pounds. But tell me, based on what order can one dare to speak this way? Case: a monk asked Dasui, when the fire at the end of an aeon rages through and the whole universe is destroyed, is this destroyed or not? Dasui said, destroyed. The monk said, then it goes along with the rest? Dasui said, goes along with the rest. A monk asked Longji, when the fire ending the aeon ranges through the whole universe, ranges through and the whole universe is destroyed, is this destroyed or not? Longji said, not destroyed. The monk said, why is it not destroyed? Longji said, because it is the same as the universe. Verse, destroyed, not destroyed. Going along with that, the billion world universe and their phrases, after all, there's no hook and chain action. Their feet are much obstructed by entangling vines. Do you understand or not? For a matter which is distinctly clear, punctiliousness is extreme. Those who know the heart bring it forth. Don't haggle. You'll lose me buying and selling at the market. There's a little backstory on this koan, otherwise it's just totally incomprehensible. Indian thinking, Western thinking, there's an idea that the world was created at a particular time. For example, in the Book of Genesis, it said that God created the world. And then at the end of time, there's going to be a complete destruction of everything, which is called the apocalypse. Right? And in Western people think there was creation, and then there's going to be the end of the world, and everything's going to be destroyed, and then there'll be a new purified heaven and earth, basically. Well, in Indian thinking, it's a little different, because there was an idea that there is going to be a universe will appear, and it will continue for a while, but it will eventually deteriorate, and it will be destroyed in a kind of cataclysm like an apocalypse. But then there'll be a new universe, and it'll all start again, and this will go on forever and ever without end. And there's many, many, in fact, there's countless universes. So the classical Indian view of the world would be that there are universes beyond number, like sands in the sea, and some of them are just being born, and some of them are being in the middle age, and some of them are being destroyed by this aeonic fire, okay? And this process is going on forever. It sounds very modern, doesn't it? Very much like science, you know. So anyway, this is about a monk who comes to see Master Dasui, and he says, when the fire at the end of an aeon, a period, a universe's lifespan, when the fire at the end of a universe's lifespan rages through and the whole universe is destroyed, is this awakened mind, or is this reality, fundamental reality, is Mu Xin, you could say, destroyed or not? Now, we're expecting Dasui to say, of course not, you know, Buddha mind can't be destroyed. But Dasui says, oh no, it's destroyed too. And the monk says, what? Even Buddha mind is destroyed? Dasui says, yeah, I'm afraid so. Okay, so then the monk goes to see, maybe the same monk, goes to see Longji. It's like, you know, have you ever gotten advice from somebody you don't like and you go look for somebody else to give you the advice you want? So he goes to see Longji. And he says, listen, when the fire ending the lifespan of the universe rages through and the whole universe is destroyed, is Buddha mind going to be destroyed or not? Longji said, oh no, no chance. And Longji said, why is it not destroyed? He said, because Buddha mind is the universe. Now, this is quite a koan, you know. It's one of my favorite koans. And we won't get through it today. But maybe scratch the surface. Maybe we'll have a chance to do this beautiful koan together. But that's the backstory, you know. I've been practicing Zen for 30-some years, and I want you to know that if you're working on your koan and you're feeling frustrated, you're not the first person to feel that way, okay? Everybody would like to be like Zen genius, right? So you pass the Mu koan, and after you pass, it says in the Mu Monkan, after you pass the Mu koan, your eyebrows will be interwoven with the bodhisattvas and the founders. So it's like after you pass the Mu koan, your eyebrows are interwoven with Bodhidharma, Linji, you know, in other words, you're in the club now, right? You know, you're in the Dharma club. And you think, great, you know, I passed the Mu koan, you know, give me another koan, you know, I'm ready, you know, I can take on anything. And so then you're given the koan and you sit down and you go into deep Mu Xin and there it is, right? You're blank mind, all right. And then you give, I might give you a koan like, the tea ladle goes in the hot water and it goes in the cold water. You know, tell me about the tea ladle. And you, tea ladle. I can handle a tea ladle. Easy, you know. You sit down, okay, you know, let me add it, you know. You sit down on the cushion and it's like, okay, you're going dependably into Mu Xin. And then, you know, you think hot water, cold water, hot water, cold water, hot water, cold water, you know. Nothing. Right? Nothing. And it can be frustrating, as working with the Mu koan, you know. Basically you're in blank mind, but the koan is it has to percolate down into your big mind. You know, when you're sitting facing the blank wall of Mu, which actually is called Piquan, which is facing the wall. This is just like Bodhidharma. When you face the wall of Mu, you know, you're looking at the big mind with the little mind, so to speak. This is one way to think about it. And so when little mind looks at big mind, all it ever sees is blankness and darkness. That's never going to change, you know. Now what's happening is that big mind is starting to process. It's like the little computer is now on hold and the information is being fed to the big computer, right? And it's a big computer and we're not very skillful at using the computer. You know, so it takes a while to become more skillful and more trusting of the process, right? And we want to be Zen genius. So, hot water, cold water, I'll sit down, you know, boom, I can't answer them fast enough. You know, I just come in every dokusan, and boom, 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 you know. Get another one, you know. But it's not like that, right? Because we're not skillful. And indeed, we still have many, many karmic obstacles, many mental habits. So when you sit down on the cushion and you say, hot water, cold water, hot water, cold water, you know, and nothing happens, you know, and day one, hot water, cold water, day two, hot water, cold water, day three, hot water, cold water, day four, hot water, cold water, God damn it, you know, the session is almost over, you know, and I haven't answered my koan, you know. And you can come in and I can go, well, you know, nobody said it was easy, you know. But and then you go through, sooner or later you go through, you begin to, it's like looking in, you know, there's an old joke that I read somewhere where a woman was writing about her experience with some of her, she was a graduate student, and she was writing about her experience with some of her male professors. And basically she said, some of her male professors, when they imagine themselves, they think of themselves as Harrison Ford, when they really look like Chris Farley, you know? That was kind of what she said. We have an ideal image of ourselves, right? And then, you know, we kind of confront maybe another image of ourselves that we don't necessarily want to see. So we sit down on the cushion, and we go hot water, cold water, hot water, cold water. We want it to be the Zen genius, right? And when it becomes painfully clear that we're not the Zen genius, right? Then we begin to, it's like looking in the mirror and suddenly seeing, I don't look that much like Harrison Ford after all, you know what I mean? You begin to say, you see yourself, right? You're sitting on the cushion and you get mad. And you go, God, I hate myself, you know? Why do I never win? You know, I can never win, you know? Every time I've, you know, bought a lottery ticket, I've never won, you know, it's, you know, and there's just something about me, you know, I'm just a loser, you know, people think, you know, this is fucked, this is a bunch of crap, what a scam, you know, or, you know, who knows, you know, but you go through a range of pity of poor me, you know, I'm poor, I'm a pitiful, I'm weak, I'm helpless, you know, I'm just straw drifting along. These are all the stories we've told about ourselves, right? And we vacillate, you know, between one minute we were the Zen genius and we couldn't wait to get on the cushion, and the next minute we're the scum of the earth, you know, and it's like we flipped back and forth, you know, between those two. And there's a powerful undercurrent in most people's, most people have a powerful undercurrent of disappointment with themselves, you know, and self-dislike. You know, maybe not everybody's like that, but I think it's very typical for people to have that that view. And we really can either lose confidence in the process, or we can wind up despising ourselves, you know. A lot of Zen practice is is sort of pushing you actually into situations like this, you know, where you fail for a while. And it's not comfortable failing, you know, and yet, you know, it's absolutely indispensable. It's like pain, you know. If you didn't have any pain, you could never concentrate deeply. And failure is so important. It's so much part of the process because there's nothing except for pain. I don't know anything that's more liberating than failure. Because, you know, it's failure that forces us to see all of these foolish dreams, the foolishness of a lot of our dreams, and also it's failure that forces us to work through our ghosts, you know, these things that haunt us. And so, you know, everybody who does Zen has failed most of the time. This is very important to understand, you know. So, you know, you might be doing a koan, especially a tough one, for a number of sessions. And so some sessions are 5 days long and some sessions are, let's say it takes you a year to answer a really tough koan. So that would be 3 sessions of 5 days, right? So that's 15 days. And then you would have 15, you'd have 29 days. And one of them would be a good day, right? One of them would be the one where you pass the koan. The other 28 are all, keep trying, you know, you're doing a good job, but that's not the answer, you know, and so on. So it's like fail, 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 fail. Okay. Okay. And then, you know, as your reward, here's another koan. Right? Fail, 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 fail. And so this is actually an ideal situation, really. I mean, people I think failure is so liberating. It's so liberating because we really have to get outside of our small selves. It really requires that, you know. Some people think of Zen practice. You know, if you say, I'm going away to a Zen sesshin, you know, they have no, you know, Zen retreat. You know, it's like, oh, how wonderful. You know, just, get up in the morning and, you know, at 7:30, have, you know, breakfast, you know, a buffet style, you know, and then we're going to discuss the sutras and have a little sutra work, some workshops, right? We'll have some workshops and then there'll be some meditation and get in a circle and meditate, you know. And then it's lunch, you know, and then free time, you know. And then we'll do like tea ceremony or Zen calligraphy little workshop, you know. But it's never going to happen, you know. So anyway, people think that's what it's about, right? And they also think, you know, it must be so nice to be, you know, to be at peace, you know, to chill out. And Zen, of course, is not about, of course, there's a deep sense of peace that arises at many moments in Zen practice, and also there's a kind of stillness which is present even in the most, you know, stillness in the middle of the loudest racket you can imagine. If you keep practicing, you can easily find it, you know. But Zen is not about like, going somewhere and it's very quiet and, you know, basically we're just dwelling in peaceful stillness and just trying to get out of pain and just having bliss. You know, that would be actually a drug. You know, that wouldn't be good for people. Zen is about encountering these obstacles, you know, and between ourselves and the world, and gradually dissolving the boundary between ourselves and the world, taking those boundaries away. So this is actually very challenging, it's very, very hard work, and it requires a great courage, you know, great, I mean, look, everybody in this room has been, we've been sitting 8 or 9, if you count sutra recitation, you know, we're down on the mat 9 hours a day, struggling with fatigue, you know, sometimes illness, sometimes, you know, And it takes incredible mental training to, you know, first it's very hard to focus the mind on one thing, like the breath, and to hold it still on the breath for an hour. You know, that's and then to take away the breath and there's just emptiness, no object of attention, and sustain that state. This is incredibly difficult, you know. And then, you know, we're encountering all of these barriers in ourselves. And they're not just in ourselves, they're culturally constructed barriers, you know. They're culturally constructed barriers. So all of this requires, of course, you're at the end of it, you're probably going to feel, I hope, very purified, you know. When I get up in the morning after doing a day of Zen, I get up and I just feel like every atom in my body has been purified. And it is a deep sense of stillness and peace. But the method is to come up to our barriers and work through our barriers, you know. And the goal is unification with the world, with the real, see. So Zen, I think, is not at all what people think, you know. It's not about blissing out. It's not about being at peace and just peace. It's confronting barriers and working them through, see. And as I say, you know, when people start doing Zen practice and they're working with the breath, they eventually enter samadhi. And samadhi is so great. It's like sugar. You know, it's so sweet. You know, you sit on the cushion, you watch your breath, and then the boundary between yourself and the world starts to go away, and it's just like, oh man, is this great. I love samadhi. Oh, you know, I love this Zen. But, you know, if you stay there, you don't wake up. That's just a very superficial state. And your teacher, if you have a good teacher, your teacher should immediately grab you and go, oh no. You know, you're not going to stay there. It's time to work on the mu koan, right? And then you sit in front of this blank wall for 3 years, huffing and puffing, right? Going, I hate this. What happened to my beautiful samadhi? And that was so sweet. That was like sugar. You know, this is like a bitter pill. You know, but nobody's doing you any favors by. I mean, there are systems of belief that say that state is the highest state. In fact, in the Buddha's own time, there were people who said, oh no, that's it, that's the encounter with God, that blissful state. But the Buddha said, oh no, this is a very partial and limited state. This is totally unsatisfactory. Why? Because you are still blocking out the world. It's very important. This is really quite a point of difference between, say, Buddhism and mainstream Hinduism. You know, even though they have the same roots, they branch off in very different directions. You know, so basically, at least some religious teachers from India that I've read. You know, they say, you know, you want to transcend this world. That's the goal, to transcend the world. And get to a higher plane. Interestingly, this is quite common. You know, I was reading the other day, Swami Vivekananda said, he was talking about a religion in general, but he said, all religion is a struggle against nature. A struggle to transcend nature. See, now, I must say, I love Indian culture. I love the music. When I first read the Bhagavad Gita, it blew the top of my head off. I just thought, this is, they don't write books like this where I'm from. You know, this is great, you know. And I love the architecture. I like the food. You know, of the music, but I can't buy that, you know, myself. That's not my path. But many people believe that, you know, that that our goal is to transcend this world. Now, people who were raised in the West also believe exactly the same thing, right? When people die, their little kids are told, well, you know, grandma has gone to a better place, right? A better place. And I grew up with those teachings. I mean, I grew up being told that this is a fallen world. This is a fallen world. And I was told that this world is this is not our home. This world is not our home. Heaven is our home. And I was told we are pilgrims here on earth. In other words, we're going on a journey. We're here for a little while. This is like a place of testing. And then we're going to return to our home, which is somewhere else, somewhere a better place. I took in these lessons with my mother's milk, so to speak, right? You know, and they have deep effect. You know, they have a deep, very hard to free ourselves from these lessons. You know, and you might think, well, you know, I never took this stuff very seriously, but it's very deeply is woven into the fabric of culture. You know, it just is. You know, some of the people I trusted most in life used to tell me that this world is not our home. You know, there's a better place somewhere else, and it sinks in, even if you don't think it is. It's going to sink in. You know, these messages stay with us. You know, I was thinking about we might not think they do, but they stick with us, you know. Even after we might no longer be believers, you know, we still believe these deep basic ideas, you know. When I was a little kid, I believed very deeply and completely in Santa Claus, you know. Really, my mother encouraged me to believe in Santa Claus, and I deeply believed in. And my mother would go to elaborate lengths to make it. You know, we would leave cookies and milk out. We didn't have a fireplace, but at Christmas in our apartment, my mother had a cardboard fireplace she would build. And I would say, but how can Santa get down the fireplace, Mom? You know, and she, well, he's magic. He's magic. He can do it. You know. And so we put out the cookies and the milk for Santa, you know, and I would be so excited. Oh, he might. And my mother and father would stay up and wrap the presents after we'd gone to sleep. And at one time, I'd come up in the morning, the milk was gone. Oh my God, he ate the cookie. You know, he ate the milk. Oh, I was so thrilled by this, you know. I loved those, you know, the miracle of the presents, right? You know, you get up in the, well, first of all, my mother used to take my brother and me to the biggest store in town when we were living in Baltimore just before Christmas, she'd take each of us individually to Hoshel Cohen's department store. And it was like a magic world, right? And there were Christmas trees all over and reindeer and, you know, ding, jingle, 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 you know, in the air, and we'd go up to like there was a restaurant, and we'd go to the restaurant and we'd have like a banana split, and I was like, oh man, this is great. Now all of this is because of Santa, you know, and I would be so excited, and it was just that incredible, right? Basically, I remember when I was about 10 years old, some kid said, I said, oh, is Santa getting ready for Santa? Maybe I wasn't 10, but I might have been, because I really wanted to believe in Santa. You know, I was like going to high school and I still wanted to believe in Santa. And some guy said, there's no Santa Claus, hasn't your mother told you that yet, right? You know. But you know, basically, you know, even though I know there's no Santa Claus, you know, for a long time, Christmas was like very magical, all the same, you know, it was like very magical. And as I got older, I realized, you know, wait a minute, you know, aren't we just being indoctrinated into buying a bunch of presents, you know? And I really think Christmas, you know, Christmas was really, is like a, it really teaches you, the religion of Christmas is like the religion of consumer capitalism. I hope you, the people I say that to people, they get so mad at me, you know, it's like, but really, I mean, Santa Claus is, if you're good, you get presents, you know, they're wonderful, they're mysterious, you know, there's a magical place and you open your presents and you're really like learning how to love buying things, right? You go, you know, you tell Santa, here's what I, you go to the department store and you say at the department store, bring me these gifts, please. And the, okay, I'm bringing them, you know. Okay, now when I say this to people, they get so mad. They go, you're really overinterpreting. Right? You're really overinterpreting this, you know. And my, in particular, my wife, you know, this drives her crazy. Because I don't give Christmas gifts. I said, oh, no, I'm not. I'm an atheist, a Christmas atheist. She goes, oh, you Scrooge. Scrooge. Oh, a Scrooge. That's the worst thing, right? You Scrooge. And I've made this, and she, oh, you're overinterpreting, you know. So okay, I'm overinterpreting. We go to a department store, we tell a magical being, here are the gifts we want, right? They're delivered on Christmas Day. Okay, now, I'm overinterpreting. What do you think Christmas is about? Well, it's about a man who lives at the North Pole, and he makes toys with his elves, and he brings them in a sleigh, right? Okay. Okay, if that's what you think. All right. You know, I'm the cynic. I'm the Scrooge. Okay. But the lesson, see, if there, and my wife knows intellectually there's no Santa Claus, right? But the lesson is so powerful that it's like a basic instinct, you know? It's like the day after Thanksgiving, the bells start going up, you know? And it's like, uh-oh, I think the Christmas music is coming. Ah! You know, okay. No! You know, okay. And it's always the same music, right? It's like, okay, you can see. But the thing is, it's irresistible, right? Okay, so these things have, this is a, I mean, actually, has huge impact, right? I mean, we could live much more simply, couldn't we? We could live much more simply. But all of our way of life is tied in with a kind of mystical quest for happiness through our material possessions, yeah? Now, you know, we also get lessons, very basic lessons, in many cultures that the world is not a good place to be. And you think, oh, I don't believe any of that stuff. You know, I don't believe the world was created in 7 days, blah, blah, blah. But all the same, you know, there's a moment when the fallback position is, I hate this world. There's got to be a better place than this world. There's got to be. Right? Now, you know, if that's what you want to believe, feel free. You know? But you should understand, Zen is, Buddhism is the very opposite perspective. You know, Buddhism is all about saying, this world is my true self. This world is my true self. This heaven, I don't think there, personally, don't think there is a heaven, except for this moment. You know, from the Buddhist standpoint, every time you say, I hate this world, that's a failure of perception, a failure of understanding. Every time you say, I hate myself, and I wish I was dead, that's a failure of understanding. Every time you say, this is a wicked world and an evil place, that's a failure of perception. It's not a sin, it's just you're in too small a mind. And Buddhism is all about, this world is my true home. This world is my true self. See? And again and again we encounter barriers. I mean, let's, you know, it's easy on a sunny day, a beautiful day, you know, you just got a check in the mail, it's a bonus, your bonus, you know, you've been promoted, whatever. Somebody you care about called you and said, oh, I care about you so much, you know, you're a wonderful person. You know, you go outside and think, life is good, it's all good, right? But when we encounter the barriers, that's when we go, this is shit. You know, I want another world. And believe me, in my opinion, that attitude is destroying this world. In my opinion, that mentality, I mean, we can't trash this world and then go to a better one. This is it. And so that mentality has had an incredibly powerful impact on what 6.3 billion people do every day, busily destroying what they don't see as their home, what they don't see as their true self. You know, last night we were listening to the insects, and I thought, you know, we throw at nature, you know, there's a guy down my street who has contracted with Chemlawn Company, and they come in a green truck. It's deceptive. It should have skulls on it, right? You know, it's a green truck, and it has a happy picture. It should have skulls, you know, this is the death wagon, right? And they come out and they spray all this stuff on the yard, and it kills, you know, it's like they use something called Dursban, which is a neurotoxin. This is like insanity, right? So you can have a bug-free, can you imagine what would happen if the earth were bug-free? Can you imagine? It'd be the end. You know, we're sitting here last night and a beautiful chorus of, you know, And you know, melting into the world, which is my true body, my true home, right? And I think, my God, you know, nature, we keep throwing these death bombs at nature and it keeps springing back, you know. It's trying so hard to save us, you know. It's trying so hard to save us from our two small minds, yes? So I personally, you know, again, everybody's free to choose his path. Maybe there is a better world, and maybe we're here to transcend. But, you know, if you stay in the world a little bit, you know, you say, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it. But at some point you say, you know, this is a wonderful, wonderful place to be. Can't imagine a better place than this moment. And that's awakened mind. That's awakening. That can be shallow or it can be deep, but that's what we're all about. So quite different, yeah, quite different. And it takes a long time to work through these cultural constructions, personal tragedies and also cultural constructions. You know, the world's an evil place, fallen world, there's a better place, and all of this stuff is, as I said, I took it in with my mother's milk. And it's not just the West, other cultures believe this too, you know. But, fortunately, you know, not everybody perceives things this way. And among them, Siddhartha Gautama. So, please enter deep mushin. And when you go into that complete emptiness, yes? Sometimes the world springs up with an incredible vitality and beauty. Even if it's a lawnmower outside, you know, we make distinctions. We say, oh, I love the sound of insects, but I don't like the sound of a lawnmower. But, you know, that's your discriminating mind, you know. One day, I've told this story many times, but, you know, one day I was... you know, we finished sashin at my house, and I said goodbye to Yen and Jaru and Jim and a number of other people, and goodbye, goodbye, and I sat down and I heard this beautiful sound. It was like, I don't know, it was like nothing I'd ever heard before, and I thought, what is that beautiful sound? And I went outside and it's a sprinkler going, shh, 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 shh. know, but I could, it's like I could hear every drop. And with purified mind in accord with the way. It's just beautiful. Right? Yeah. So anyway, don't beat yourself up if you don't answer your koan. And just do your best. Try hard. And please don't, in my advice, you're free to do what you want, but please don't try to transcend. In my opinion, that's not... the world is quite beautiful. It's a great pity we can't see that. And I think there's something rather ungrateful about things not good enough. So anyway, a monk asked Da Sui, when the fire at the end of an aeon rages through and the whole universe is destroyed, is this destroyed or not? Da Sui said, destroyed. The monk said, then this goes with it? Da Sui said, yeah, that goes with it. A monk, whatever happens is okay. Whatever happens, this moment, if the universe is being destroyed right now, no problem. Okay. Da Sui said, that's fine with me. Monk at Longji, when the fire ending the aeon rages through and the whole universe is destroyed, is this destroyed or not? Not destroyed. Everything is your true self. Everything. Even the fire, is your true self. So please, the goal, the gate to that true self is Wu, empty mind. Please go deep into Mushin and let's experience this beautiful, untranscendent world together.